In a survey a few years ago, a random selection of Australians were asked about their relationships and particularly about marriage. When asked what's the best part of being a couple, whether it's a married couple or some other form of couple, what's the best part of being a couple, the top answer was friendship. When asked what things harm your relationship, the following were given: lack of time together, lack of understanding, lack of communication, lack of financial security. The respondents were asked their views on why people marry. Not why they got married, if they were married, but why do you think other people get married? The most common responses were that people get married for two reasons. First one is to publicly show their commitment to somebody else. And the second top answer was to provide security for their children. Then they were asked why people might not get married. The top answers included someone might have had a previous bad experience, there is a fear of making a mistake, a dislike of commitment, a positive preference for being single, or a view that marriage just isn't necessary to show your commitment to a partner. Over the last month, we've been doing a series called Redeeming Relationships and reading the Old Testament book of Ruth. As we've been reading that book, we've noticed that relationships can provide great joy and great support, but also there is a lot of pain in relationships. Today at both services, morning and evening, we'll be considering the topic Redeeming Marriage. And next week at the evening service, we'll conclude our series by looking at the topic Redeeming Singleness. When I talk about redeeming marriage, what I mean is improving or strengthening marriage. We know that relationships are living things and they can improve or they can deteriorate. They can break down. And that can happen in marriage as in any relationship. So to redeem marriage as such is to try and do whatever it takes to improve, to strengthen, to keep a marriage healthy. Now Christians know that they can have some help in this because we can call on God's grace and God's Spirit to help us in our attempts to redeem our relationships. In many ways, redeeming relationships or redeeming marriage is the whole story of the Bible as God tries to redeem the relationship He has created with His people. So for Christians, there is always hope. And I want to say this quite clearly to you this morning, that whatever situation you're in this morning, relationally speaking, whatever situation you're in, there is hope. And the reason I can say that so confidently is that because I believe in a God who is keen on redeeming relationships. I see that through the pages of the Bible, story after story of God's attempt to redeem His relationship with us and His encouragement to us to redeem relationships around us. And we're given the help of God Himself by His Spirit, and that Holy Spirit allows us, if we so allow God to do this, allows us to reflect God's love and His forgiveness and His grace in our relationships. So there is always hope. Now, the situation in Australia is something like this. Most recent Australian Bureau of Statistics statistics that I was able to get were from the year 2009. In the year 2009, around 120,000 marriages were registered in Australia. In the same year, around 50,000 divorces were granted. About half of those divorces involved children under 18 years of age. The median length of the marriages that were granted divorce was 12.3 years. So what we can say in general is that in Australia, a lot of people still get married. In fact, the most number of marriages ever registered in one year was that year of 2009. But there are also a lot of marriages that break down and a lot of associated pain involved. Now, we know from scriptures like those we've had read out from Genesis 2 and 1 Corinthians 7 that marriage is God's idea, So that's reassuring, isn't it? When you start smashing those plates, just remember, this is God's idea. And although not everyone will get married or stay married, and Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 says there are some distinct advantages in being single, God intends for those of us who are married that marriage is actually a good thing. It's a blessing. But we know from experience that Christians struggle with marriage like anybody does, and that we need help. Now, this morning, we're going to look at just one aspect of redeeming marriage. It's around the issue of communication and conflict and forgiveness. And I'm going to ask Bev and Graham Churchwood and Paul and Kay Sampson, who are the leaders of something we do here at St Alfred's called the Marriage Course, if they would come up and lead us and help us and give us some suggestions on how we can redeem our marriage by thinking particularly about issues of conflict and forgiveness. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Graham.
Thanks, Peter. So following on from what Peter said, this image that we've got up here that many of you are familiar with is a very helpful way of looking at marriage. It shows seven aspects of a lasting marriage. In particular today, as Peter said, we're talking about resolving conflict and forgiveness. So if we look at the marriage wheel up here, every wheel, even the one that Cadell Evans rode recently, the hub of the wheel represents the core values. For Bev and myself, and for many of you, God is at the centre of our marriage. The rim of the wheel is what holds it together. And you'll notice around there that the rim has the word commitment, an essential part of marriage. Marriage involves promising to be loyal, to stick together, to work through new situations, difficulties, and problems. For some couples, at certain times in their relationship, that commitment might be the only thing that keeps them together. But marriages can be restored, they can be redeemed. We might feel content that we've got a good, stable marriage, but marriage isn't static. It's designed to be a dynamic relationship that keeps changing and keeps growing. That's why we like the picture of the marriage as a wheel. A wheel is designed for a purpose, to turn and to move forward. The reality of life, as we all know, is that the pathway of life and the pathway of marriage can at times be rocky. Life changes, stuff happens, and conflict can and does occur. I love the honesty of the Bible. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 28, how's this for encouragement? But those who marry will face trouble in this life. That's honest, and in my experience, it is true. Disagreements are inevitable and normal in every marriage. And obviously, the need for conflict resolution and forgiveness is relevant to singles, workers, and other relationships. It's not unique to marriage. So why is conflict inevitable? If marriage is God's idea in the first place, how come conflict is inevitable? Some reasons. The main reason, of course, is that we are all different. We're different in lots of ways. Different background, different desires, different priorities, different personalities mean that we perceive things, we see things differently, and we won't necessarily always agree. So there's all those differences. Added to that, we're all naturally self-centred. We find it easier to focus on my desires, my opinions, my needs, rather than those of our husband or wife. Conflict is destructive, and when we try to force or manipulate our partner into doing things our way, when we see ourselves as being on opposite sides, that's the issue. However, in marriage, we're on the same side, on the same team. So what are some of the good principles for resolving conflict? We're going to walk through four major principles that Bev and I and many of you have found very helpful. The first is focusing on what we like and admire about our partner needs to be something that we practice on a daily basis, a habit that we get into. Professor John Gottman, a psychologist who has analysed the habits of married couples for over 30 years, says that he reckons he's able to tell within the first 5 minutes of watching a couple whether or not their relationship is in trouble. He says that a key indicator is, are they showing appreciation of each other? His advice to couples is, by simply reminding yourself of your partner's positive qualities, even as you grapple each other with each other's flaws, you can prevent a happy marriage from declining. So that was the first point. The second point is that we need to both identify but also accept our differences. We can be different in so many ways. How we make decisions, how we restore energy. On Friday nights when I get home, being a bit of an extrovert, I'm always thinking about, you know, who can I talk to, who can I mix with, whereas introverts such as Bev generally prefer to relax quietly on a Friday night. And so regularly Friday night we have this issue come up. With personality differences, one attitude is not better or worse than one another. It's just different. Our upbringing and our parents' attitude will have affected how we behave and how we think, and we can come into marriage with different values in all sorts of areas. Bev will talk about the third point.
People respond to conflict differently. Not everyone smashes plates. Some try to force their partner to do things their way. They go on the attack. And others surrender. They may be frightened of disagreements and they just want to hide, run away and do anything to prevent that confrontation. And still others bargain. They say, I'll do this if you do that. But unfortunately, that soon becomes, I won't do my bit because you're not doing your bit. And none of these approaches builds closeness or is effective in conflict resolution. However, there is effectiveness through negotiation, and negotiation enables us to involve discussion of the issue that causes that tension and finding a solution that works for us, Graham and I, you and your partner, as a couple. And what works for us might not necessarily work for you. It is very individual. So there are six very practical steps for negotiating areas of conflict. And the first one is finding the best time. Now, I'm sure all of you can identify straight away what are the particularly bad times to bring up and resolve arguments. So, number one, in front of other people, just before a special occasion, or when you're just about to leave to go to work, or when you've just come home at the end of a long, hard day. But I think the number one worst time is late at night. And some of us, that's when we actually start the conversation that quickly leads into an argument. When we're tired, we can so easily get things out of perspective. And often our most futile arguments are late at night. So Graham and I call in the 10 o'clock rule. And I know some of you have heard this on the marriage course, but we've actually practiced it. In fact, Graham's the one that calls it in the most. But when I talk when I talk about the 10 o'clock rule, what I mean is that one of you decides, okay, I'm calling in the 10 o'clock rule, we're going to postpone this discussion, this argument, to another time that is more appropriate, that works better for us. And that might mean it's the next evening, or it might mean it's the next day over a cup of coffee. The thing I find very difficult about it is that sometimes I need to get it out. But for me, I'm learning self-discipline. So I'm sure for some of you that's another area that you need to learn as well. The second step is to identify the issue. And we know that so easily arguments can widen out, and all of a sudden other tangents come in and other things just, yeah, sort of somehow navigate into that initial discussion. And sometimes it's really hard to remember what it was at the very beginning of the argument. We've lost it. Identifying and discussing the issue can be the most important part of preventing disagreements escalating. An analogy that we find really helpful, in fact, when I first heard of this, I thought, yes, that's what we need to do, was the picture of a three-seater couch, the wife at one end and the husband at the other, and the contentious issue is often right there, sitting right in the middle, right between us, keeping us apart and stopping us from hearing each other properly or seeing each other's perspective. So identifying the issue means that we're actually taking that contentious issue and we're putting it out in front of us so that then as a couple we can move together, close together, without that looming up between us to then address that issue out in front. That way, we can actually work towards finding a good solution. The third step is to discuss the issue rather than attack each other. There are two phrases that some very wise people have said you must never use in marriage. One is, you always, or you never. I'm sure we can all identify with that and we probably use them. But when we use one of these phrases, we're actually attacking the other person's character. For example, you never do anything to help, or you always make us late. It is so much better to use I statements describing our own feelings. So for example, rather than you never do anything to help me, it's much more productive to say, I feel really upset when you don't help me clear up in the evening before we go to bed. It's just so much softer, isn't it? And we're actually talking about how we're feeling, our hurts, rather than attacking the character of our partner. Equally important is to be a really good listener. And during an argument, we often find that we're really keen to push our own agenda, our own point of view. And we're not often very understanding or very willing to listen to the other person. But a simple but very effective ground rule is to take it in turns. Now, very kindly, Paul and Kay have agreed to come up and demonstrate to us the tool of effective listening. So, Paul and Kay, if you're happy to come up now. Kay's got an issue and she's going to talk to Paul about it. One issue. And Kay, we're going to keep it short.
Yep. Okay, so hopefully I've chosen something that some of you women in the audience might be able to relate to. And unfortunately for Paul, I haven't told him what it's going to be. So we'll put him out of his misery. So, the issue that I thought that I would bring up today is that I'm really concerned about the fact that your work interferes so much with our life. I feel that it's not compartmentalised into a section of our week, and that each day it's encroaching in our relationship and also the relationship that you have with your children. And I just think that maybe that you need to organise your time a little bit better so that it has a place, maybe that's important to you, a place and a time set aside for it. So you know, not at the kitchen table that we have to share in your work stresses and probably not not on a weekend it'd be nice, one out of the 2 days for you not to work. And maybe part of this work is your mobile as well. And that, you know, I've come to bed at times and you're sitting there checking your emails, and that's not overly romantic.
So we've got the hanky here to remind each other the person who's talking, so that's why I've just taken that hanky back. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I know that we've discussed it a lot, and I guess that's something on it. We've talked about this quite a lot, but we don't actually seem, we don't seem to have come to a solution that actually is working. So we need to do something rather than not talk about it maybe.
Thanks for picking an easy one too. So just to reflect on what you said, that my work isn't just at work. It's actually when I come home that my brain's still thinking, and then it can impact on time with you and time with the kids. And that it doesn't sort of stop, that it can encroach in our family life and our relationship. And that what I heard was that you're worried about the impact it places upon us as a family, us as a couple, and myself. Was that right? Is there anything that you thought we could do to work on this?
I really think that you... I think it would be really good if you could come up with a plan to have, you know, certain nights of the week or certain times at night, or like maybe at once the children have gone to bed or something. I guess a plan is what I'm asking for, yeah, that we discuss.
So just to reflect on what you said there, so it's work getting in the way of relationship and family and probably me too, that we've talked about it a few times but haven't put a plan in place. I can understand and see the impact that it places on everyone because I feel it too. Thought about it this morning with relationship with James, so I understand that. Finding it really hard to find the right plan, so I'd like to try and put that in place, if you could help me. So I won't report back to the group next week, but we'll certainly help put a plan in place. Whilst we're up here, is that what you thought of, or was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, you've done very well.
Well, as you appreciate, that's a pretty brave thing to do in front of a few hundred people. So, yes, thank you very much on behalf of us all. So just following on from that, yes, it's important to listen to each other. Yes, it's important to reflect and make sure that we're understood. And I suppose one of the big things that I've learnt in the last few years in this area is the importance of Bev feeling listened to, and not just me saying, oh, you know, that's easy, I'll come up with a solution, we can fix it up this way, but taking time to make sure that I've got the message, because sometimes we jump in there, we think we've understood it all, we've come up with a solution when Bev just wants to be heard, or, you know, a solution is important. As Paul and Kay did, they talked about possible solutions. Paul suggested something and they talked about different possible solutions. And so just to take another example, in the interviews earlier in the service, people were saying that money is a really big issue. So if there's a conflict over money, it could be a matter of let's talk about, you know, possible solutions. And that could be simply a matter of, well, let's, you know, write down what we're spending money on, let's put the credit card aside and just use cash for the next month. It could be that we review our expenditure at the end of the the week or month or something like that. Or it could be that we'll go and talk to Doug Petering or somebody who's absolutely brilliant with money and he can give us a few tips. So sometimes it's helpful to write down a whole list of possible solutions, and then we can come back to them. So the fifth of the six steps of resolving conflict is to say, well, there's a range of solutions here. Let's pick one of those solutions, try it out, see if it's helpful for us, and obviously if it works, then we've got a solution, and that's wonderful. And then the sixth and final step is one that is often overlooked, and that is, what if it doesn't work? What if the solution we came up with, so what if Paul agrees to come up with a plan and 3 or 4 weeks later there is there's a plan that's still not actually happening? So the sixth step is really is to reevaluate it and say, well, is it working? Have things actually changed? And both be open to the possibility that the plan that we tried to put in place is not actually working, at which point there's the opportunity to go back and talk about other solutions. And in that sense, it's very freeing if we both accept that the solution we've tried to put in place hasn't actually worked. We can explore other options, and we can agree that that first solution didn't work. Let's look for another one. So these six steps that we've talked about up here are really helpful ways of working through conflict. The whole process of resolving conflict through negotiation involves each of us asking ourselves, how do I need to change? Often when there's tension between us, we need space, and for many people and for many of us, talking to God and praying is an important part of that. In our reading that Brian gave us today, Paul encourages couples to be devoted to prayer. Why is that the case? Expecting our husband or wife to be the ideal partner and to meet all of our needs will cause a marriage to spiral downwards. Expectations which are not fulfilled lead us to making demands on each other, which then lead to disappointment because no human being can meet all of our needs. And then there's disappointment, and then there's blame, and there's criticism. As we look to God instead for those needs, it makes a big difference. And the triangle up here tries to encapsulate that, that when we look to God for his unconditional love that we all crave for a sense of significance, security and self-esteem, and then as those needs are met, we're better able to give to each other.
Of course, often with conflict resolution, with conflict, there is pain, there is hurt. So how do we go about healing hurt? First of all, we need to identify the hurt. Whether we've hurt our partner or been hurt, we need to take the initiative to bring it out into the open so that things can be healed. I acknowledge it isn't easy, and small hurts can build up and need to be healed just as much as big hurts. The second part of the healing process is to say sorry. Apologising involves taking responsibility. It's recognising what I have done wrong. And sometimes, I acknowledge too, it's very hard to admit, to say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Our pride makes it difficult for us to hear from our partner how we've upset them too, or hurt them. To say, I'm so sorry for whatever it is, I know it hurt you, I'm going to try not to do it again. Please forgive me. That is so incredibly powerful in a marriage. The third part of the process of healing hurt is forgiveness. Forgiveness is essential in marriage, but forgiveness is really hard. It's always costly. Forgiveness means giving up our self-pity, giving up the desire for justice, giving up our rights, putting aside our pride. Every act of forgiveness costs us something, whether we're forgiving something large or something small. When I was trying to think about a recent major type conflict that Graham and I have had in our relationship, I really struggled to... I mean, there's been lots of sort of little sort of tiffs and things like that, but what did come to mind was a time when we were on holiday. We actually were away overseas for our 30th wedding anniversary, and we'd had a lovely week in the south of France, and we were then going to have 2 days up in Paris. So two, what I thought, my expectations were this wonderful, romantic 2 days, two full days, two nights in the most wonderful city of the world. You know, it's known for its, you know, it's the city of love after all. This was my expectation. Prior to going, when we were organising our trip, I don't like booking accommodation. I find it really tedious. But I'm also, at the same time, I like to know where I'm going. And so I come in at the default, you know, stage to say, oh, no, I don't really like that. Try again. Or, you know, really, that's just not up to scratch. I'm sick of slumming it. I'm not going to be in a tent or a caravan any longer. I want a really nice room in a hotel. So when it came to Paris, we were having this sort of tentative argument, and Graham reassured me that this particular hotel was lovely, it was central. Okay, it's 3-star, but it's going to be okay. You can be reassured it's okay. So I thought, I have to trust my husband. So we arrived in Paris. It was incredibly cold. It was the middle of winter. It was dark. We just had a long train trip from the south of France. And I was really hungry and just, you know, feeling that little bit, oh, I can't wait to get to the hotel. We arrived and we were ushered into this very small room. It was very tasteful, very small, and it was on the inner aspect. Now, in my imaginings, I imagined this wonderful room with a balcony, you know, the black lace work on the veranda, all of that. Instead, I looked out the window, peered through the Tyrolean, that says it all, onto this inner courtyard, and I could see the refuse bins down below, and I thought, oh, okay. Well, I started to seethe. My emotions came to the fore, and I thought, oh, I'm just so disappointed. I'm really disappointed. And I thought, what am I going to do with this? No, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to give him the cold shoulder. So I went into a sulk for the next, well, it was more than half an hour. But yeah. We actually, after settling into this hotel room, we left the hotel and we thought we would walk along the Champs-Élysées and find somewhere to eat. So I did not say a word all the way. We were probably halfway up the Champs-Élysées by this stage, and Graham picked up that there was something wrong. By this stage, I couldn't hold it in any longer, really. And so I was starting to say, look, you know, it just really isn't good enough. You know, you assured me that this was going to be a really nice room and blah, 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 and so it went on. So I was actually accusing him and, you know, getting quite verbal in my...
So I probably... I probably should give my version of events. A friend had recommended this place to me.
No excuses.
That's my excuse. The room was tiny, it was dingy, it was not good. Normally I would have, if it was inadequate, I would have immediately gone down and tried to, you know, get a better room. But I thought, blow it. Bev's got really annoyed about this for no good reason. I'm just going to let her stew. And I did.
So So here we are walking along the most romantic boulevard of the of the city. And as you can see, the lights were just glorious because it was just after Christmas. And I'm just getting more and more cross and thinking all those sideways thoughts, like, he always does this. Every time we go away, he always books the cheaper accommodation. But when I jump in and book the more expensive accommodation, he really likes it when we go there. So I could then start to hear myself, and I can't, to be honest, I can't remember if I said it out loud or I'm thinking it.
You did.
Oh, okay. You always book the cheaper accommodation and you don't think about what I would like. And the minute I said you always, I actually thought back to the marriage course and I thought, oh, I've said that word. You know? And I thought, oh, this is just so, you know, it's just not so nice. And so Graham actually, at that point, he said to me, are you going to forgive me? And I found that incredibly confronting because I was still seething with anger. And although I'd had this, you know, sort of check in my spirit because I actually had said those words. So I was then able to say to him, yes, I'm willing to forgive you. And although it was hard, it was a real release. And even though I knew I had to forgive him, I also knew that I didn't want this particular conflict to spoil the rest of our time in Paris or the rest of our holiday. So it was a choice that I made at that particular time. Are you happy with that?
And yes, certainly for more than half an hour, we were really, you know, walking along the main street of Paris, you know, beautiful city, we were really annoyed with each other. But equally, I had to forgive Bev. I mean, Bev had totally overreacted and I needed to...
I think you should go and sit down now. That's one thing about being the service leader, you know. Of course, there are degrees of difficulty and hurt, and there's a huge difference between forgiving someone for their booking of hotel accommodation to forgiving a betrayal of trust. And however difficult it is, we must forgive. Forgiveness is not just about feelings. It is, as I said, it's making a choice, the choice to let go of resentment. So forgiveness means letting go of the past, choosing to forgive as an act of our will, not because we like it or we feel like it. Forgiveness means releasing the person who has hurt us, whether that's our husband or wife or someone else, from what we think they deserve, even if they don't apologise or recognise what they've done. We release them into God's hands. We release them to God, we're leaving the consequences also to him. The Christian understanding of forgiveness is that God forgives us freely, and therefore we must forgive each other freely. And it helps me to think of that forgiveness flowing into our lives from God and then flowing out of us to those around us, and especially to those who are closest to us. Where there is forgiveness at the heart of a marriage, it has unparalleled power to bring healing. Let me pray for each other. Lord God, bring us together as one, reconciled with you and reconciled with each other. You made us in your likeness. You gave us your Son, Jesus Christ. He has forgiven us from sin. Lord God, bring us together as one. We are different, but given new life in Jesus Christ. Together we are your body, your church, your people. Lord, bring us together as one, reconciled, healed, forgiven, sharing you with others as you have called us to do. In Jesus Christ, let us be together as one. Amen.